here's the secret. I've made the same film over and over again. And each film asks, don't tell anybody, each film asks one deceptively simple question. Who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And what does an investigation of our past tell us about not only where we've been, the subject that I'm working on, but where we are now and where we may be going? People like to say history repeats itself. It never has. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So whenever I finish a film, I realize the extent to which it's rhyming in the present, good and bad ways, and therefore what an extraordinary teacher, as I suggested, history can be.
Welcome to the Beyond Speaking podcast from Premier Speakers Bureau, featuring in-depth conversations with the world's most in-demand keynote speakers.
Hi, I'm Brian Lord, president of Premier Speakers Bureau. Welcome to the Beyond Speaking podcast. Our guest today is Ken Burns. Ken has been making documentary films for almost 50 years. Since the Academy Award nominated Brooklyn Bridge in 1981, Ken has gone on to direct and produce some of the most acclaimed historical documentaries ever made, from the Civil War and baseball, two of my favorites, to country music, and most recently, the U.S. and the Holocaust. His future film products or projects include The American Buffalo, Leonardo da Vinci, The American Revolution, and Emancipation. And in November of 2022, a year ago, Ken was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame. And in a way, I've been doing interviews for years and years. Ken was one of my earliest interviewers, as I was able to interview him a bit back when I was a high school senior, believe it or not. So 30 years ago. So this is a cool thing for me. So Ken, thank you so much for being on the Beyond Speaking podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brian.
So one of the things that everybody asks, and it's an easy way to start, but how did you get into doing documentaries?
You know, it was really kind of born in tragedy. My mom had cancer from the time I was a year and a half or 2 years old. She died when I was 11, a couple months short of my 12th birthday. And afterwards, my dad, who had a strict curfew, let me stay up late watching movies on TV. And we were watching a movie one night and he cried. And I'd never seen my dad cry, not when my mom was sick, not when she passed away, not at her impossibly sad funeral. And I realized that's what I want to do. If film had produced a safe harbor where he could express himself, I wanted to be a part of that. And in the mid-1960s, that meant, you know, becoming Alfred Hitchcock or John Ford. And I ended up going to Hampshire College, an experimental school in Amherst, Massachusetts. And all of the teachers of film were social documentary still photographers. So I'm at 12, I want to be a filmmaker. At 18, I want to be documentary films. And at 21, it wants to be an American history, which I've completely untutored and untrained in American history, but it had always animated me, that sense of love of my country and the complexity of it. And we too often make our history superficial. So I was interested in telling really complex stories that would, you know, make my dad and everybody else cry, you know, I hope is the way to say it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the things that whenever I ask people, I said, well, what should I ask Ken when I get to talk to him? And they said, well, he's just so fascinating. Like, that's the word that kept coming up. He's so fascinating. I'm like, what questions do you want to ask? And so what do you think it is about what you do that is so fascinating?
I don't think it's me. I think it's the stories that we tell. I think we have a superficial, conventional version of our past. It's easy for us to package it. It's easy for us because there's so much information for us to say, let's put it that way. But the real past is so instructive, is the best teacher we have, and so complicated and so nuanced that sometimes a thing and the opposite of a thing, as Wynton Marsalis said in our jazz series, could be true at the same time. And so I spend my life sometimes working 10 years on a project, making all of these minute moments come alive and resonate. And that's what's interesting. People say, you know, we made a film on Muhammad Ali a few years ago, 4 parts, you know, 8 hours. People said, there's nothing more you can say. Some of the best documentaries have been on Muhammad Ali. And afterwards they said, oh my God, I thought I knew him. And I did. And so that's the greatest thing. People, scholars of a particular subject, we're working right now. I was just rushing in from a meeting we were having about our film on the American Revolution, which will be out in 2025. And, you know, this is something that's just drowning in treacle and sentimentality and fife and drum kind of stuff. And it's so much more interesting than that. And I was trying to describe to some folks all of the stuff that over the last 6 years, 7 years that we've been working on it, we've understood and come to know and the nuances and complexities. So it ain't me. It's just the stories that we tell.
Well, I've got to say, I think you do have to have an idea or a really good eye for what comes alive. What's kind of your response when you say, oh, this is something I never knew and I have to tell it?
Well, let's just think about what history is. History is everything that's come before this moment, right? And so when somebody says, honey, how was your day? You don't say, I back slowly down the driveway, avoiding the garbage can at the curb, unless somebody T-bones you, in which case that's exactly the way you set it up. You just cut the touch, oh, my boss is an SOB. Oh, this happened. You'll never believe who I met. And so we edit human experience. And so what I think we do is we find those people who we trust to edit human experience, to say, and with history, you've got a great responsibility because history doesn't come out. Stuff doesn't come out with any structure to it. We impose the structure of story, which we've known since Aristotle, you know, beginning, middle, and end, characters, antagonists, character development, climax, denouement, all those things we've known for thousands of years. That's how people talk. That's how they communicate. That's how paintings and films and plays and dances and symphonies are done. It's kind of based on the story that we're communicating. And so for me, I've got this double-edged thing. I need to impose story. And at the same time, I have to let the raw material influence what that story is. So in our editing room, we have a little lowercase cursive neon sign that says it's complicated. And you know, there's not a filmmaker in the world that, you know, if a film is seen as working, you don't want to change it. And I've spent 50 years changing scenes because you want to make it better and truer. And I think the reason why our films are so popular, you know, the big series get on the first time they're broadcast, sometimes, you know, 40 million people at the first showing of it, you know, it's because they're not expecting the thing. They're going to learn something new. That's stuff they knew, like, oh, yes, the Constitutional Convention. Oh, yes, the Declaration of Independence. Oh, the American Revolution. They're going to understand that something they thought was true wasn't true. And a lot of things that they had no idea about were super important to why that event is, to at least me, very fascinating. So, you know, here's the secret. I've made the same film over and over again. And each film asks, don't tell anybody, each film asks one deceptively simple question. Who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And what does an investigation of our past tell us about not only where we've been, the subject that I'm working on, but where we are now and where we may be going? People like to say history repeats itself. It never has. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So whenever I finish a film, I realize the extent to which it's rhyming in the present, good and bad ways. And therefore, what an extraordinary teacher, as I suggested, history can be.
I don't think you mentioned that your dad probably wasn't watching a documentary or something of history when he cried.
He was watching an old feature film called Odd Man Out by Sir Carol Reed about the Irish Troubles in the 19-teens and 20s. James Mason is a guy who, in a robbery, kills a cop and the whole world is after them. And it has a Thelma and Louise ending. And my dad cried. Oh, and I just kind of went, wow, I had never seen that happen. And I went to my late father-in-law was a very eminent psychologist. And I said, I keep forgetting the day my mom died. I see it coming up and then I see it receding, but I'm never present the day he dies. He goes, yeah, I bet you blew the birthday candles on your cake out, wishing she'd come back. And I go, how did you know that? He listed five other things that I did. He knew exactly what I had done. He said, look what you do for a living. And I said, what? He said, you wake the dead. You make Abraham Lincoln and Jackie Robinson come alive. Who do you think you're really trying to wake up? Mm. And it made the kind of emotional archaeology that I had described what we did, not just excavating dry dates and facts and events, because who wants that anymore? We had that in school. There's no test next Tuesday. It's just the emotional archaeology is what holds it together, not sentiment or nostalgia, but the higher emotions that are central to our faith, to our art, to everything. And that was animated by this early tragedy and how I have made an entire professional life out of something that's absent, my mom. It's just, it's to me still revelatory on a daily basis and animates the enthusiasm that I have at 70 years old to keep doing this and juggling four or five projects at once. And, you know, am totally greedy for the creative process. Seven days a week. And if I don't put my head on the pillow and say I've made a film better, then I don't feel like it's been a good day.
That's so good. And you answer questions that haven't even been asked yet. That was actually my next question, was your quote from your father-in-law about why you picked history. And you've answered that already. So
waking the dead. If I ever have time for a memoir, which I can't imagine that I would, because the film projects are so compelling and we're scheduled out to the end of the decade. And they're all underway. I mean, these are not just kind of pie in the sky stuff. They're all in various stages of completion. I would call it waking the dead.
Well, you said that you need to tell stories as difficult as they may need to be told. What role does courage play in what you do, and where does that come from?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we lament today that we don't have any heroes. Everybody wrings their hands. There are no heroes anymore. And then when you examine what heroes, you know, find a person who is perfect, I can't find one in history. So we're talking, the very notion of heroism invented by the Greeks is that you are looking, in the Greek, just think of the gods as boldface names. So we take somebody really well known, and we're going to tell you a story about them, and it's going to show not their perfection, but their strengths and weaknesses. And it's the negotiation, sometimes the war between those strengths and the weaknesses, that define heroism. Then all of a sudden that opens it up, and there are heroes everywhere. So you can't tell Abraham Lincoln, who's, to my mind, with George Washington, the greatest presidents we've ever had, without showing the sides, the undertow, because that makes them complete. And when people don't hear that superficial, sanitized Madison Avenue version of stuff, they go, boy, that's a lot like my life. You know, I have complicated, you know, I've done that too. Or I can feel a better connection to this person because I understand not just their strength, but their weaknesses as well. And that, to me, is at the hallmark of this. What do we think is the greatest stories ever told? And certainly it's Shakespeare, if you're dealing with plays. And the most important ones that you remember, like Hamlet and Macbeth and King Lear, these are tragedies. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at someone wrestling and trying to come to terms with their own demons, and either reconciling those or not. And in tragedy, not. And so I think that's a very interesting thing. Just think of, like, one of the most beloved American movies of all time. Everybody's seen it, is It's a Wonderful Life. Mm-hmm. So a Martian comes down and said, oh, I see everyone likes It's a Wonderful Life. What's it about? It's about a guy who decides to commit suicide because he doesn't think his life is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. That is as American. That was Frank Capra, the director's favorite film. And that was Jimmy Stewart. And I spoke to him, his favorite movie.
Hmm.
I mean, wow. I had dinner with Jimmy Stewart. And I mean, first of all, I just couldn't believe I was having dinner with Jimmy Stewart. And he told me stories about how he made Mr. Smith to Washington. But he said, that's my favorite film. And think about it. We're all George Bailey. We're all faced with this question. And this is maybe animating all my work. Where do you want to live? In Pottersville or Bedford Falls? Right. The town that George Bailey is the center of with his good and generous heart, or the kind of acquisitive, transactional world of the old man Potter, the parsimonious, mean banker. Right.
Yeah.
Of course, we know where we want to live. And so this is the essence of how you get to the heart of a good story. Does it have tragedy in it? Yes. Is it contemplating tough stuff? Yeah, but you'd never think, wait a second, America, one of their most favorite movies is this?
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. And so it makes me wonder, you've researched so many people. Who do you feel is the most complex president that you've studied?
Every single one, but the most important ones are the three most important presidents, and that's Washington. Without him, we're not here. Mm-hmm. Sort of like if you're having an argument about who's the best player in baseball, you have to say besides Babe Ruth, because you don't really have a national pastime without Ruth, or the Beatles if you're having an argument about the best band. And then it's Lincoln and it's FDR. They're really complicated people. There's dark interiors. Everybody, like all of us in our lives, even the people close to us, remain inscrutable to the end. And so, you know, there's that opacity that you're trying to penetrate. You're trying to say, who are you, Franklin? Who are you, Abraham? You know, it's true of LBJ. I'm working on a project now about LBJ and his great society. You know, one of the great tragic figures of the Vietnam era. You know, it's true of just about everybody that I've come across. And that mystery is an animating force. It's not a negative thing. It's exciting to not know something. I collect American quilts, and I, you know, the most I can understand of a quilt is it might have been made because she signed it by somebody named Hannah in 1870. Where is Hannah from? Maybe we know it's Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Maybe we don't. But is Hannah 12? Is she 18? Is she 26? Is she 80? Is she happy? Is she sad? You know, I don't know. There are these mysteries that I can't, you know, at least in the films I make, I can like answer most of the questions, not all of them, and make what you can answer tantalizing enough that they're a dimension of the story. But those quilts on my wall, you know, if I could turn this machine around, you'd see there's one right up here. They're like, who did this? Who are you? Tell me your secrets, you know, and you just kind of in the end have to just accept that the not knowing of it.
Absolutely. Well, I do have, you know, when I interview somebody like you, it's great because I have so many questions that people send in. So I want to get to those within our time here. So this one's from Brian Palmer in Chicago. What are the most important things in choosing a documentary topic?
Well, you know, you can't think about it. I've got lots of ideas for films, but until they drop down to my heart or my gut. So I think to me, it's feeling that you've got a story in all its complexity firing on all cylinders. And at that moment, you say yes. Sometimes it might take you 10 or 30 years to say yes to the idea. Sometimes it's instantaneous. I mean, a friend of mine said, why don't you do something on country music? And I went, yes. And from that moment on, we were working on country music. You know what I mean? But the Buffalo film that we just put out, The American Buffalo, that to great success, we'd been talking about for 30 years. It wasn't no less an important subject. It was just, we needed to find the daylight. We needed to be better filmmakers. We needed to have scholarship happen. And so there's lots of factors that go into the decision to say yes. And it's like, you can't identify why out of your high school class, you knew everybody, you know, quarter were acquaintances, you know, 15 were good friends and 5 were best friends. And 1, you'll know your whole life, you know, who, you know, how does that happen? People say chemistry and you can't really separate the materials to tell you exactly what it is.
Wow. Hey, so being in Music City ourselves here with country music, what was your biggest surprise in country music, or either biggest surprise or favorite thing?
Well, I just think it's how profound it is. You know, with 3 chords and the truth, Harlan Howard, a songwriter, said, you know, and that means that country music is elementally on the surface simple. But when you have, you know, Johnny Cash, I Still Miss Someone, or I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry by Hank Williams, or Dolly Parton's, you know, I Will Always Love You. Here's a song in which they basically go, I will always love you, I will always love you, I will always love you. Like, that's the basic love song, right?
Yeah.
But it is so much more than that. And it takes the genius of somebody like Dolly Parton or a Merle Haggard, The Bottle Let Me Down, or, you know, Hank or Johnny to do this. So it's kind of this American haiku poetry that is at the elemental, the things that we care about, you know, the joy of birth, the sadness of death, losing somebody, falling in and out of love, just all of that. We make fun of it and we say, oh, it's about 6-pack of beer and pickup truck. It's so little about that. Mm-hmm. It's about memory and loss and sadness and, you know, what I've lost and what I wish to gain back and how I loved and how I lost that love or how I got that love. I mean, it's just as basic and as elemental as a punch in the face. I love it.
That's great. Next question is from Drew Colley in Hendersonville, Tennessee. What's it like having the whole world use your Ken Burns effect in flight?
Yeah. So that's a kind of Steve Jobs did it, invited me in and asked me to approve it. But it's essentially a superficial version of what we try to do when we take an old photograph, is treat it like the feature filmmaker I had originally wanted to be, with a master shot, a long shot, a medium shot, a close shot, a tilt, a pan, a reveal, insert of details, all of that sort of stuff. And to try to make that photograph come alive and not just you know, look at it, but listen to it. Are the cannon firing? Are the troops tramping? Is the bat cracking? And so what he did was he had, you know, you put your photographs in and it kind of dissolves and zooms and you can add music to it. So it's a kind of elemental use of it. And it's so funny because when we do it, we get so into the weeds and so complicated about it. And this is a simple thing that's on every Mac computer in the universe. And it has saved so many weddings and vacations and memorial services and bar mitzvahs and whatever for people. That they come up and they tell me this all the time. And I'm very happy. But you're looking at a Luddite. My kids use it all the time. But we do it in these very sophisticated editing, you know, programs that other people actually, you know, use the mouse and do the stuff. So it's just me in an elemental way wanting to, as we've been saying, wake the dead.
Well, this one's kind of a two-parter. One is a person just kind of threw in the question. So one of them, Vince Vicente in Dallas, said that his daughter was so inspired by you that she started doing her own documentary in my father's footsteps. And then another said, you've inspired so many people. Do you have a protege that you are training to follow in your footsteps? That's Jamador in New York.
Well, you know, I have the great privilege. Thank you for those questions. You know, part of doing what you do is to give it away, right? And so I've done a masterclass. I have no secrets. We've always brought in interns. The people that are working with me now came, you know, I'm my senior editor is a gal who came at age 18 to work in our editing room in the early 80s, right? And she's about to retire after she finishes the American Revolution project, and she's priceless. And I work with my oldest daughter, Sarah. She and her husband are co-directors with me on the Muhammad Ali film that I mentioned. There are a lot of people who've stayed with us, a lot of people who've moved on. And more importantly, through some great philanthropy by the Better Angels Society, and particularly Jonathan and Jeannie Levine, the Library of Congress gives away a prize every year called the Ken Burns LOC Levine Prize in film, $200,000 to the winner to finish that film, $50,000 to the runner-up, and four times $25,000 to the next honorable mentions, which is the $25,000 alone. It would have been a windfall when I was working on my first film, Brooklyn Bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is the biggest prize there is. And so it means we're helping even people that I don't personally know get along. And we also do this at with regard to the National History Day, identifying middle school and high schoolers and give them awards and prizes to help them in the films that they make. So we love it. We think having films that don't have a political agenda, but just want to tell complicated stories about us, meaning capital us is the US, and us is the intimate two-letter plural pronoun, that all of the intimacy of us and we and our. And if we can get lots of people doing that, then some of the divisions we have in our country, you know, disappear. Because we share a past. Past can be not only a great teacher, but a great sort of reconciler of the difficulties.
And I love what you keep saying about how complex things are. Like, things are just are not simple. And I think when we make things too simple, they kind of get a little, crazy.
Well, what happens is we get binary. You know, you know, the novelist Richard Powers says the best arguments in the world won't change a single person's point of view. The only thing that can do that is a good story. And all we do is argue. Right? We think everything is binary. There's nothing binary in nature, nothing. And so what we need to do is always tolerate nuance. The guy that you're so against probably shares 95% in common with you. And so that's where you begin, rather than what you believe that. Well, I believe that, you know, and that's where we get into all the trouble we've had.
With the rise of TikTok, short videos, and seemingly shorter attention spans, have you changed how you create documentaries, or are you concerned about the future of the format?
No, not at all. In fact, the format is just, we thought we were in a golden age in the mid 80s, and it's only gotten more golden as we've gone through the decades. Look, when the Civil War series came out in 1990, all the critics said, this is so great, Ken, but no one's going to watch it because they're watching MTV videos. Right. And the people would say that again for baseball and again for jazz and again for the big series. And then they stopped saying MTV. They started saying YouTube videos and a cat playing with a ball of yarn. People have always had short attention spans. And yet the thing that really matters to all people, all meaning, accrues in duration. The work that you're proudest of, the relationships you care the most about, have benefited from your sustained attention. We have now a tsunami of information that's coming at us. What do? We select and we binge. Well, how is binging not committing? I mean, I've got a little gal who watches, you know, 11 seasons of Modern Family, 11 times 23 or 24 or 26, whatever it is, half hour plus shows. How is that not focusing? How is that a loss of attention, right? Somebody says, what? I never got around to seeing The Sopranos, and I just sat down, and over the last 4 weeks, I binged it. That's like reading War and Peace, only longer, right? So I would suggest that, we've always been distracted by kitten with ball of yarn. And in fact, there is nothing wrong with laughing and enjoying a kitten with a ball of yarn. But we're also drawn to the things that have meaning, that have benefited from our sustained attention.
All right. So last question for you. When you look back on your career, what are you most proud of?
Well, I don't call it a career. The novelist and poet Robert Penn Warren looked at me and said, careerism is death. You know, he terrified me when he said this. So I've always referred to my professional life. And I have to tell you that the number one thing I'm proudest of my co-productions of my four daughters, you range in age from 41 to 37 to 18 to 13. And that's important. I don't have a favorite film because I don't have a favorite daughter. I've just tried to practice and get better at it. And what I know is someone came up to me, the last film that we had out before The Buffalo was called The U.S. and the Holocaust, a pretty difficult film, got a lot of airplay. A lot of people talked about it. It was very much on conversation. And somebody came up to me and said, is the most important event since the birth of Christ in human history, the Holocaust? And I looked at him and I said, no. And immediately said, it's the American Revolution. It's the birth of the United States of America. For all its flaws and for all its glory, there is no better story. And I will tell you, Brian, if I were given 1,000 years to live, which I won't be given, I would not run out of stories in American history.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Ken, for coming on and being part of the podcast. And for anyone watching, listening, make sure to subscribe. Check out Ken's profile on our website. And again, Ken, thank you so much for taking your valuable time and being on this podcast.
Oh, happy to be with you, Brian. Good to see you again.
Yeah. Nice seeing you. It's been a good 30 years. Hopefully we'll get to talk to each other a little sooner.
Not every 30 years. You might be talking to a gravestone. We'll see.